Okay, well, let's get started. Josh, great to see you.
Great to see you as always. I look forward to these more than you might imagine.
Yeah, it's good. Well, this is really important stuff. So let's just jump right in. So imagine this scene, and it's based on what versions of what we see all the time. A CEO or a lead negotiator is walking in to start negotiating a large deal, say $10 million, and they're still Googling negotiation tactics on their phone while they're in the elevator just to try and top themselves up.
You're creating a lot of pain for me to even imagine that scenario. And the bummer here is that I think it actually happens a lot more than you might know or people might expect. And the other reality is that might even be more advanced than some people who are just walking in without even doing the Google search.
Well, yeah, you absolutely have a point. I mean, the day before, someone is reading through, the 7 power moves for winning a negotiation, or trying to get tips and tricks, just as they're going in there, as if this is how they're going to actually negotiate a good deal. I mean, this is exactly what we call ad hocery.
Yeah, peek ad hocery. So for catch people up here on what ad hocery is, this is level one in our negotiation capability model. And again, this is our organizational negotiation framework. And what we're talking about when we see ad hocery is behavior where people are kind of winging it. So you can have these peaks and valleys, but you're not going to have consistently high performance. It's kind of like jazz without the talent.
Yeah, but here's the thing, jazz musicians practice scales for years. They do the foundational work. Ad hocery is kind of more like karaoke after 3 drinks. You might nail it once, but
If they're anything like me, it's mostly loud and mostly off key at that point.
yeah.
So, not really a really aspirational form of music and probably not a very aspirational form of negotiation either. So, I think today you and I are going to hop in here and talk about what ad hocery really looks like and why it's costing serious money. And here's the good news, how we can fix it without becoming a massive bureaucracy in the process.
Yeah. Because once you recognize you're sort of doing negotiation karaoke, you can't look at it the same as always.
All right, so let's shift to a quick primer just to catch people up if they haven't been following along in our entire series here.
Yeah.
So our negotiation capability model has 4 levels. So we can think of it, if you want to have some fun with it, like a video game where you want to level up as you go. So let's
Yes.
talk about level one here, Gary.
Yeah, so level one mentioned this before, ad hocery. It's kind of random chaos. It may be a bit controlled chaos, but nonetheless, it's sort of making it up as you go along each and every time. Level two is where you move up to what we call repeatable competency. You've got the basics down, you've got a process, you know how to approach pretty much every negotiation foundationally. And so you actually can repeat your successes. Once you really anchor around that or do that well, then level three, we call adaptive flexibility. You're doing the basics, you have the foundations, but now you're adjusting, adapting to the context, kind of like a pro. And of course, there is a level four, which is optimized performance. You're basically the negotiation equivalent of a Formula One pit crew.
Yeah, where do we think most negotiations are? Well, we kind of know here from experience that most of them, unfortunately, are stuck at level one. So thinking that they just need to hire that magical unicorn negotiator who will solve everything and trust them, empower them with all the autonomy to go at it and just see how it goes.
Yeah, it's kind of like, thinking about a failing restaurant, hiring one amazing chef, but they don't have recipes, they don't have a good menu, they don't have suppliers, they frankly don't even have all the kitchen equipment, right? Even Gordon Ramsay can't cook in that environment.
Yeah, and here's the weird part, Gary. A lot of these same companies that you and I deal with, they do think about things from a behavioral engineering standpoint. They do think about things from an organizational standpoint. They have things like Six Sigma for manufacturing. They have Agile for software development. They have detailed playbooks for sales, but then when it comes to negotiation, they give them the old attaboy and say, just go in there and do your best, champ.
Yeah, it actually is quite surprising when you think of it that way. I mean, if you think about, Kaizen and how tight we do just-in-time deliveries now, and how coordinated, how much preparation is required to deliver that, right? And yet, when it comes to negotiation, like you said, we just say, well, let's hire someone who we think has good experience, turn them loose, and hope for the best. So let's get specific. What does ad hocery actually look like out there in the wild? So imagine you're running procurement for a regional hospital network. Okay? 18 months ago, protective equipment was bored. It's a commodity, right? Stable prices, plenty of suppliers competing, no drama. This, of course, is the perfect time to build relationships with suppliers, to map out alternatives, to look at plan Bs, maybe even create a regional buying consortium so that you build stability and predictability in. But it's boring. So what do? We do them on a one-off basis.
Yeah, but if we start thinking about the future, isn't that just future Josh's problem? Currently, this Josh is fighting 17 other fires. How am I supposed to be strategic about these things?
Yeah, of course. And that's why it ends up being done in an ad hoc way. But then imagine, not like we've seen this, a respiratory outbreak hits three states over. Suddenly, every hospital from here, say it's in the Northwest, in Seattle, is panic buying. Prices don't just increase, they go full hockey stick, straight up. Your team now has 48 hours to secure inventory before your ICU runs out.
And now we're imagining chaos. And this is really where we're starting to see the pain of ad hocery. So no benchmarks to follow to know if you're getting fleeced. No backup suppliers have been vetted. The CFO may want a lower cost, but the chief medical officer wants highest quality. So now you have no internal alignment at your back tables. The CEO just wants it done yesterday. Again, misalignment as we go. And in this scramble, imagine you sign a 5-year exclusive at 3 times the normal pricing. How do you evaluate whether that was successful or not, other than maybe the person who was at the table says, we did great.
Yeah, and your medical staff have equipment. So what do? We celebrate. We got supplies. Meanwhile, you just locked into what could be a massive overpayment for not one, not two, but 5 years. But we're still celebrating in the break room.
Yeah, I don't even like cake that much. So this one's got me really troubled. Let me give you another scenario, Gary. Imagine this. So you're leading a consortium bidding on a small city project. We're talking $2 billion over 10 years. Your lead negotiator gets food poisoning 72 hours before final submission. The backup, they think LOT is a typo, which is actually a term of art in this situation. What do you do when that star negotiator you had can't show up at the table? What are you going to do then?
Yeah, something no one likes to think about, but happens. So imagine they don't even realize in the RFP there's really a bit of a poison pill, unlimited liability for a data breach, for example, in the sensor network. They miss that the labor union just signed a new contract that adds about 10 or 15 or 20% to their overtime costs. They definitely haven't figured out or heard or looked into that the competitor just locked up the only qualified sensor manufacturer in North America that you'd want to work with. Now what?
But if we're on the stage on this karaoke, that approach to negotiation, the show must go on, right? So they may submit a bid that looks competitive, but is actually a financial suicide note. You win the contract. So again, congratulations. You just won the right to lose money for a decade. And this is not being facetious. This is what we see play out over and over again in that hockery.
Yeah, no, it's right. And it often gets written off to, well, was the best we could do. Let's take a sporting example. Sports. Imagine you're running a major sports federation negotiating broadcast rights for a new tournament. The European and American deals get all the attention. That's where the heat seems to be. So imagine the Asian rights getting tossed in to whoever's free on Thursday. It's just sort of an add-on.
Yeah, what this person might not imagine or understand is that the Asian markets are mobile first. and they don't know that highlight clips on social platforms could be worth tens of millions. That might be actually where most of the value is. They don't realize that they're about to give digital rights away for free in the fine print, because again, so much is happening at the table as to all the other work that we know makes most of the difference.
Or most of the work is done in a very short lead-up period when the pressure gets on. So this background work is not a normal part of the negotiation process. So imagine they sign a traditional TV deal that looks great in the press release, but leaves massive digital value on the table. And then a few years later, you're in court trying to claw back rights you didn't know you gave away, trying to argue that for somehow you just didn't understand it. No court's going to give you much leeway on that.
No, and the root cause is clear. The pattern's always the same. Time pressure plus no process equals expensive surprises.
So let's talk about the damage that's harder to measure. In fact, that nobody measures, the invisible costs of ad hocery.
Yeah, so let me introduce cost number one here, what we might call relationship arson. So again, let's get a scenario to think this through a little bit. Let's imagine a software company promising real-time analytics to win a Fortune 500 deal. One small problem, their engineers haven't even started building it. So 6 months later, imagine that strategic partnership becomes a lawsuit. The settlement, pretty painful. The lost lifetime value, pretty devastating, because that breach of trust is fundamental to being able to ever reestablish that relationship.
Yeah, and those kinds of scenarios get around into the industry pretty quickly, and it becomes harder then to even entertain or negotiate other deals. Huge cost. Let me throw cost number two on the table. Opportunity blindness. Imagine two biotech companies spending 6 months fighting over who should pay for phase two trials. They spend their time, energy, and money focused on trying to win that negotiation. They're arguing over millions while missing the fact that combining their compounds, getting to market more quickly, could create a multi-billion dollar breakthrough or a value out there through the joint combined therapy. It's kind of like fighting over who pays for gas for the truck while all the produce is rotting in the back.
Oh, that myopic definition of success is really painful to watch play out too. Let me talk about cost three here. This one's my personal favorite. Organizational amnesia. So that loss of any institutional memory. So imagine a global retailer in this instance, where every region negotiates independently. Europe discovers fuel hedging saves significant costs. Asia develops a return process, cutting disputes dramatically. America creates a surge capacity model guaranteeing holiday inventory. But imagine none of them know what the others learned and how problematic that is. Rather than sharing best practices, we are just creating these silos of forgetfulness.
Yeah, I mean, imagine kids at school and they're given a project to work on as a team, and all of them start at the beginning and do all the work without coordinating. They're all just repeating each other's work over and over again with no synergy at all. It's inefficient and kind of crazy.
Yeah, I see my students do it all the time. They throw it all in a Google Doc and they never even have one conversation in the process. So here's what we know from our work. And I think you and I are pretty passionate about this. Organizations are stuck in ad hocery, consistently underperform. Full stop. They leave value on the table, they damage relationships, they miss opportunities. And how much are we talking here? Well, of course, it varies a bit by industry and context, but if we want to be very conservative, just imagine a 10% improvement that would come from solving this problem and how substantive that could be for a number of companies, organizations, and industries.
Just a 10% improvement. So, 100 million in annual negotiations, that's $10 million right to the bottom line. And that's conservative. And Josh, compare this, for example, to some manufacturing or operations where they have honed their processes down. If you can reduce one part in a complex manufacturing process by 10 cents, it adds up to millions of dollars. So that's like a 1% increase, if that, and companies will find that and implement it. Yet in the negotiation space, we're leaving all kinds of percentages of value on the table without actually paying attention to it. And that's that hidden cost of ad hocery.
Yeah, we know we wouldn't accept a 10% failure rate in flights if 10% of them ended up on the ground. So we know we have that ability to be focused and have a low tolerance for error and trying to maximize how we do things for sure. So here's one of the challenges. Some of this is a social psychology challenge, and one way to think about this is that there is survivor's arrogance. So occasionally our negotiator does pull off that miracle save, and that story becomes legend. And people start to talk about it in the office. Hey, remember when Sarah saved the Johnson deal at 2 a.m., hadn't eaten in 3 days, how cool that was? And it gets told at every company party, and they get celebrated again in that break room where we had the cake I didn't want. So we perpetuate this idea that the people who somehow pulled it off or occasionally have these victories, that we remember those, we forget about all the failure that happened along the way.
Yeah, those other nine failures, they get blamed on market conditions, nothing we could have done about it. The other party was unreasonable. We had to do something. We had to finalize a deal. That was the best we could do. So without data, the phrase we like to use is mythology beats measurement every single time. And that's the world the organization starts to live in.
Yeah, you're right. We love situational attribution when it's failure, and we love to take credit for the success, but maybe we should have a healthy dose of the opposite if we want to do this more consistently well.
Wow,
So
interesting.
let's talk about one of our favorite instruments that we've developed over the years here, which is the negotiation assessment tool, the NAT. So there are three questions that'll tell you instantly if you're in ad hocery, and you have to be pretty honest with yourself. So get ready and buckle up here.
So let me start with question one. Can you show me right now, without scrambling, without kind of taking time to have to go hunt around, just right now? Give me a written definition of success for your current negotiation. Okay? And I won't accept get a good deal or get the best deal. That doesn't count. I'm talking all dimensions. So not just price, terms, performance metrics, relationship outcomes, future possibilities or options, exit strategies, plan B, next steps, those kinds of terms. You're able to write those down right now for me, then you're in a good place. If you can't do that immediately, you're in trouble.
Yeah, if your definition of success is, I'll know it when I see it. Congratulations, you're winging it. You are in stage one, level one, ad hocery.
Here's question two. What are you measuring besides did we sign a deal? Imagine you only track closure rate, but ignore delivery, other performance metrics, quality scores, total cost of that contract or ownership, and relationship value or relationship health. That's kind of like measuring your fitness by whether you own gym shoes.
For sure. And most ad hoc organizations have one metric. Did the deal close? Yes or no? I have students that go through this in our negotiation classes, law students, MBA students. They come back and say, we got a deal, and they're all excited. And they forget to ask, was it a good deal? Do we even know what a good deal was? They don't even know how to measure it, but they were just glad to be done at that point.
Absolutely. Question three, to me, one of them, probably the most important. Could a brand new hire, someone you just brought into the organization, follow your negotiation process? Or is it all kind of hidden tribal knowledge, that you have to absorb by osmosis over a long period of time? So here's the test. Imagine your star negotiator wins the lottery tomorrow, moves to Bali.
Hey, first of all, good for them. It sounds lovely.
But what does it do to your negotiation capability if they leave on that flight to paradise? Right? If that's a problem, you don't have a process. You have a person. And whenever you have a person instead of a process, you're at level one. That's pure ad hocery.
Yeah, and look, obviously these are three simple questions, but they're pretty powerful. They give you a pretty good idea of whether or not you may be an ad hocery. We have much more advanced tools to help you get there as well to understand where you're at. But if you're listening to this and you scored 0 for 3 on these questions, don't feel bad because you have a lot of company. Frankly, you're an extensive company, but there is a way out. There is an escape route here. And the good news around all of this is that moving from ad hoc to repeatable competency isn't complicated. It's not about 200-page playbooks or certification programs, right?
No. Level two starts with three simple tools. It maybe take an hour per negotiation as a starting point. That's less time than most people spend choosing their lunch in a fancy restaurant. Walk us through those tools, Josh.
So think of it, and you can call these what you want, but the basic concepts are the key here. Something like akin to a negotiation charter. Think about one page, could be a prep sheet, but really trying to figure out some of those things we were talking about. What does success look like? What does winning look like? Who are the key stakeholders? We might want to map those stakeholders out and figure out who cares about what and why. Start to translate positions to interests so we can get to a point where we can solve things. Start to map out BATNA documentation. What's your plan B? What happens as your alternative to negotiate agreement? Also healthy to think about your WATNA. What would happen if things don't go well? Start to think about your concession strategy. What can you trade? What do you value differently? What can you offer at low cost to you that's of high value to the other side? And then, of course, think about these relationship goals as an interest that needs to be met, not just an ancillary side product of your negotiation. So, how do you want them to feel 6 months later? What are your long-term goals?
Yeah, and I always add into that too, how do you want to feel 6 months later? Because, the reality is that if somebody believes they signed a bad deal for themselves, they'll look for ways to get out of it, and that will cost you. And you will do the same thing. If you realize we signed a bad deal, you're going to look for ways out of it, and that'll cost both parties. So those relationship goals are critical. But without this simple negotiation charter, negotiation checklist, whatever you want to call it, it would be kind of like if pilots just walked onto their aircraft and figured it out as they went. Now, imagine your pilot didn't check the gas gauge, right? Pilots, by the way, are required by law to go through a specific checklist before every single flight, and that's a 35-year captain who has done it thousands of times. They are required to go through the checklist because when something is so important, you cannot risk it on memory or missing it. So why do we wing it when we're negotiating tens, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of value?
You're absolutely right. All those points of preparation are critical. And then we also want to have a plan for what we're going to do when we're at the table. This needs to be a somewhat coordinated effort with pretty clear communication plan of how we work with each other. So you could think about it even as a 20-minute pre-brief. Same agenda every time, kind of like a sports team huddle. Let's review that checklist, that charter, the prep sheet, whatever we're using. There's a whole host of tools for preparation that are effective, but we want to make sure you had good preparation. Figure out your roles. Who talks? Who take notes? Who's making the final call? Agree on some signals. What do we do to call a timeout? Where should we be fairly transparent? Where do we need to be a little more careful in what we share and why? And set some red lines. What makes us walk? These 20 minutes are not a lot to ask, but they could save you millions and they're often neglected. People are just walking in cold.
Yeah, I got called in on one case, Josh, where a bargaining team, a negotiating team at the table for hours. They agreed to a deal and they walked out in the hall, and one of the team members said, what are we going to do about X? And the rest of the team froze and said, oh man, we didn't think about that. They had just agreed to something. And this person, because they didn't have, just as you described, just something as simple as how do we call a timeout? When do we call a timeout? Who can call a timeout? Because that person didn't feel empowered. He said, well, I thought you had taken it into account. I didn't see it, but I figured you had. It was so important. they had to go back in and try and undo the deal. And you can imagine what that did to their reputation and what it did to the overall negotiation when right after you agree to something, you try and renege on it. Tool number three, the 10-minute post-action review. Not a blame session, and you're not renegotiating. You are learning what worked and what didn't. You're capturing it. So, what worked? What surprised us? What would we do differently next time? What didn't we like? And you got to write it down because you don't know on the next negotiation who's going to be there, right? This builds organizational memory. Most people go through negotiations, they're stressful, they're difficult, and at the end, when the deal's signed, they go, "Thank God I can put that out of my mind and go back to my regular job." And then a year later, 2 years later, they're thinking, "Okay, how did we do this last time? Who did what? How did this work?" And we're saying, "Oh, I think Fred was in that last negotiation. Let's go call him." And Fred's going, "Oh, yeah, what did we do?" This is again the definition of ad hocery. We're going to reinvent the wheel every single time. And of course, that means we stay at ground zero every time. It's the image of Prometheus pushing the boulder up the hill. We push it up a little way and then it rolls back down. And guess what? We seem to be happy to do that again next time. With that simple post-action review, you're creating a learning tool and a time capsule so that next time around we start where we le left off, we learn from it, and we go to that next step.
And look, Gary, I don't want people to think they can't have cake. Just because you're looking for things that you can do better the next time doesn't mean you can't celebrate. You can absolutely celebrate the wins, but you have to have some organizational honesty about what could have gone better. And to your point, how can we keep leveling up as we go? It may not be all the way up to level two the first time. It may get you closer and closer until level two is your floor and you start aspiring to other levels. And look, at the end of the day, we're trying to make this very approachable. So if you take even a couple takeaways from here, you do three things differently. If you can prepare a little bit better, if you can have a better plan for what you do at the table, and then do some reflection so that you can continue to improve, that's not bureaucracy. That's not a bunch of paperwork that's going to add overhead. That's basically adding a seatbelt, a little bit of safety here to the whole equation.
Based on our experience with many clients implementing these three basics across the organization, we consistently see meaningful improvement in outcomes. As we said before, imagine reducing bad deals even by 10%. What's that going to be worth to your bottom line? And at a cost of some simple structure, some simple process, and repeating it every time.
Starting to get pre-aspirational, Gary.
Yeah.
I'm going to give and a little bit hopeful that people are going to do a little homework. So here's the homework. And yes, homework sounds bad, but I think it's going to be fun. Pick a negotiation they've got going on in the next 2 weeks, just one, and apply these three basic phases that we're talking about: preparation, at the table, and after the negotiation. Put some tools in place, see what happens.
Yeah, and I'd say don't aim for perfection. This is not analysis paralysis by analysis. Your first negotiation charter, your first negotiation checklist will probably look a little bit like a kindergarten drawing, and that's okay because version one beats version none every single time.
Yeah, my kindergarten drawing was a very sloppy looking elephant that never deserved to be up on the wall, but my mom put it there anyways, so it's okay. It got better.
Yeah.
So here's the truth bomb. Every day that you or your organization stay in ad hocery, you're paying what Gary and I would call a randomness tax. And your competitors who've built repeatable processes, well, they're collecting that tax from you because they're much more prepared. They're going to learn better. And the other thing is, they're suffering from your inability to negotiate too. So everyone's going to have outcomes that work better for their own interests if we can all do this better. But certainly for your own self-interest and your own organization's interest, you need to get better at this too.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like playing poker where you can't see anyone else's hand, but you can't see your own hand either because you haven't really looked at it. I mean, how many of you would play poker under those circumstances? You're flying blind.
Oh, brutal. You might as well just hand your ATM card to someone and just walk away at the table at that point. So look, the distance between level one and level two is knowledge. That's a big mistake people think. If I just train up my individuals, we'll get there. Often you have the knowledge already. You have people who know your organization. You have people who have some experience at the table. It's not just resources, but it's really approach and philosophy. And these approaches are essentially free, but they pay huge dividends on the other side. So if you take that decision to stop treating negotiation like improv night at the comedy club, you're going to start having much more serious outcomes that put you in a much better place.
Yeah. So make the decision to test this out. You'll gain greatly. One template, very simple. One pre-brief with your team, roles, communication, and one debrief at the end. And you're going to make a first step from chaos into capability.
Yeah, look, negotiating on adrenaline might feel pretty exciting. I get it. But that's not negotiating with advantage. And if you need that adrenaline kick, why don't you take a nice, repeatable approach to your negotiation, then go skydiving or cliff jumping or do something else for your adrenaline kick, but don't do it at your organization's expense here.
Yeah. You know, and working at this beats being exciting and panicked when there's money on the table.
Every single time. Well, Gary, thank you so much for having the conversation. Hopefully this is of some value to our people out there, and I appreciate your time.
Yeah. Take care.